Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, NFL Week 12, Monday Night Football Edition. Hopefully all of you, our loyal listeners, have recovered from your turkey hangovers, quality time with your family, and hopefully a few winners to get you through the wild weekend. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. And Payne, how goes it getting back into your normal Monday football routine?
Gotta love it. Gotta love it. Weekend was another trying one. So it's just starting to get really frustrating around these parts.
It tests your mental fortitude week in, week out. No reason to rehash what transpired on either Saturday or Sunday. We're all too aware about that. So as we typically do around here, or I guess we do every Monday, it's all about the good, the bad, and the ugly from what we saw from the previous week in the National Football League. We'll break all of that down for you. A little bit of injury news that comes from the good Dr. Deepak to talk about how some fantasy impact players and some of your favorite teams could be with or without some marquee superstars. Look ahead lines, and of course, last but certainly not least, a breakdown of Monday Night Football's game between the Indianapolis Colts and the Pittsburgh Steelers. All right, Payne, I'm going to give you the honors right out of the gates in terms of the good. What stood out to you thus far during Week 12?
There was a good performance on the field, but as much as you'd like to not discuss yesterday, we're going to do it, and we have to discuss Trevor Lawrence. I think that was a growing moment for him. And you kind of just look what he's been doing the last month or so. Hasn't thrown an interception in five of his last six games. The bye week seemed to really get him and Doug Peterson on the same page. It provided that time to regroup. And since week seven, Trevor Lawrence, quarterback 11 in EPA plus completion percentage over expectation. Week 12 alone, top five in both completion percentage over expectation and fourth quarter EPA. And the things that are kind of narrative-based, but we know play a role in locker rooms. The body language seems to be a little bit better. His personality seems to be, I don't want to say bubbly, but the head isn't always hanging. You could literally watch him melt anytime something negative had happened in prior weeks, and he just came off as a guy that you wouldn't want to follow. But to me, a win like that with a ton of clutch fourth down moments, that could be the building block to gaining confidence and becoming a leader that players in Jacksonville's locker room actually want to follow.
Is that the team to watch that you have the most optimism in terms of the way they're trending? When you look at the Tennessee Titans, we know they're about to go through a quarterback transition of sorts. The Indianapolis Colts, no idea what's going on there, and the Houston Texans appear to be a dumpster fire. Have you seen enough to be optimistic, and not just Trevor Lawrence's performance, but that roster in general?
It's a good question. I think we've talked about Jacksonville ad nauseum and how they were playing substantially better than the record indicated. This was very much an average team by the metrics. They just continued to do dumb things in crucial moments and were looking for leaders to step up in some of those crucial moments, and they just never materialized. But in terms of best positioning for a head coach in that division, obviously Vrabel's fantastic, but you got a Super Bowl winner now in Doug Peterson that does things that is analytically driven, and he's an offensive mind, so you get a check mark there. And there's certainly, in terms of quarterback play, the highest ceiling available of anyone in that division, and there's some talent there. You just hope that they become a little bit better spenders in free agency and the draft goes a little bit better, and suddenly the mantra of Jacksonville being the place where players go to retire and collect paychecks is out the window.
You mentioned the analytically driven stuff. I loved what Doug Peterson said in his post-game press conference, that they had nothing to lose electing to go for two rather than playing for overtime. He said it was all the players that pushed him to go in that direction. They draw up a properly designed play, and yet again, the Baltimore Ravens, despite having a fourth quarter lead, can't close out a game, allowing the Cincinnati Bengals to inch ever so close to them in the AFC.
That's that's exactly what a leader says.
Yep.
Right. We know Doug Peterson was going for two regardless. He was a guy who basically innovated that and went for two the most of any coach in the NFL when he was with the Eagles. But he gives his guys the praise.
Don't tell that to Zach Wilson, all right? I mean, we don't need to tell Zach Wilson what it's like to be a leader who decides he wants to apologize to his teammates after he's been benched and moved way down on the depth chart. I want to go back to Thursday. It's a game that we talked about and thought it was going to tell us an awful lot about the Minnesota Vikings. We saw them take very real professional money, drove that number from 3.5 down as low as 2.5 in some books. But Kevin O'Connell puts together a very good offensive game plan. I mean, Justin Jefferson is an absolute cheat code out there on the outside. He's going to make any quarterback's job that much easier. But the Vikings, Payne, accumulated 231 yards in the first half. It was more than the Patriots had allowed in the previous two games combined. They went through a stretch as well where they scored on five straight possessions. While the Vikings may not be as good as their record indicated, that performance, at least on the offensive side, really opened my eyes.
Yeah, I mean, that was a tall task, right? You think about everything Minnesota was up against. It was a short week. You're playing the number one defense in the NFL that had proven to be able to shut down what you were best at, and that was defending 11 personnel passes. And you could have saw a situation where Minnesota was searching for its confidence a little bit, being embarrassed by Dallas, had you dropped that game to New England as well. And then all the narrative stuff, right, about Kirk Cousins in prime time and not playing well if the game doesn't start at one. And you hit it perfectly. Give Kevin O'Connell some kudos for some adjustments that he made, went with some heavier sets more than typically he had shown this season. That would have never happened under the old regime in Minnesota. But also, let's give Kirk Cousins some praise. Like, the man is not playing afraid. He threw into a ton of tight windows. He was fantastic doing it. I know his interception number is a touch higher than you would like this season, but I know that was a point of emphasis from Kevin O'Connell coming into the year. Like, not playing afraid. You got to throw into some tight windows. And if you look at Cousins' performance Thursday evening, completed more than 81% of his passes. That was the second highest mark ever against a Belichick-led Patriots defense. Cousins finished top three in EPA per play and completion percentage above expectation. That was a huge bounce-back win for the Vikings. And while some of the bets did not go our way this weekend, the futures bets all came up spades. And so that was good to see the Vikings not mess around and get us over 8.5.
Yeah, I mean, take care of business when opportunity avails itself and also work against the New England Patriots prospects for postseason inclusion. As far as other good performances, whether they be coaching-related, team-related, or individual performance, the floor is yours.
You kind of made that jab at Zach Wilson, so I think that's a good transition point in terms of Mike White and what he was able to do for the Jets yesterday, and give Robert Saleh some credit for pulling the right strings. You know, I think we discussed it a little bit and weren't quite sure what it meant for Zach Wilson's future, but Robert Saleh said all the right things in Zach Wilson's benching, and I think he diffused that situation really, really well. And it left the door open for Zach Wilson to return, but he got what he wanted, at least in a one-game sample. I thought Mike White proved the coach making the right decision there, right? I mean, he had the best EPA per play of any quarterback in Week 12, fifth in completion percentage over expectation. All the young receivers got involved and left the game happy, which is what you would like, right? The negative plays were negated. Mike White took one sack. He had just one turnover-worthy play. 24 of his 28 passes were deemed catchable. So that was a great performance from Mike White, and I get it. It was the Bears defense that has a chance to finish dead last in the NFL and saw one of its leaders get injured early on in that game. But I thought that was as good as you could have hoped for the Jets offense. And, you know, let's kind of monitor this situation. We've seen that one game surge from Mike White last season when he put it on the Bengals. Hopefully for Jets fans, this is a little bit more sustainable this time. But the positive is, moving forward, the Jets are going to face one defense that's above average in schedule adjusted efficiency the rest of the season. And so there's a possibility here for Mike White to just keep this offense humming a little bit here based upon the schedule and have the defense win them some games. Obviously, Carter going down, which an ankle injury, is not great, but they're doing enough to win games right now.
There have only been 8 passing days, Payne, in the history of the New York Jets organization in which a quarterback reached the 300-yard, 75% completion, and 3-touchdown threshold. Mike White owns 2 of those. Ken O'Brien has 4. Pretty incredible, and maybe more an indictment of what the Jets have done as a franchise, that nugget from Mike Cimini. But when you look at some of the other numbers, Mike White went out there, and to your point, even against a much maligned Bears defense, settled things down a little bit, especially early when it looked like the Bears had a few wrinkles up their sleeve for Trevor Siemian's game plan. The Jets settle down, hold the Bears under their team total, and allow the offense to find a little bit of separation. When you look at individual...
That situation was wild.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely incredible. I mean, to go from Trevor Siemian is hurt to Nathan Peterman, you're the guy now after just getting called up from the practice squad to hold on a second, pump the brakes. Trevor Siemian, you're back out there. I mean, the Bears PR team probably should end up in the ugly department of this segment.
That was the word, is that Trevor Siemian injured his ribs in pregame warmup, and Schefter and everyone was reporting that, hey, I mean, Nathan Peterman, who just got called up from the practice squad and was going to be the backup, is now the starter. And then apparently Trevor Siemian was like, I might not have too many opportunities to start in this league. Shoot me up and I'm getting back out there. And suddenly he rolled out there for the first possession, and a lot of people weren't quite sure of that, but that was a wild scene in and of itself.
Yeah, typical Bears, the way this season has gone. We'll, of course, see if Justin Fields is ready and available for their divisional matchup against the Green Bay Packers before they have a bye week. So imagine there's a chance that QB1 may not be back as early as this Sunday. When you look at individual performance, though, Payne, I want to highlight a guy right here in my backyard, that, of course, being Josh Jacobs. Recorded a single-game franchise record with more than 300 scrimmage yards, 229 rushing, 74 receiving, 2 rushing touchdowns, including the game-winning 86-yard touchdown run in overtime of the Raiders' 40-34 victory at Seattle. It was the second longest overtime touchdown of all time. And I have to imagine that Raiders fans, Raiders players, Raiders coaching staff, members of the front office are rueing some of those games where they collapse. When you see that kind of offensive firepower, you know what this team is capable of. Defensive performance is neither here nor there, but the Raiders flirt with nearly 600 yards offensively and end up winning outright in the Pacific Northwest as a 4-point underdog.
I think we said this earlier in the season when we talked about Josh Jacobs in a segment like this, and it was like, you just feel great for him because he's going to get paid. And this was a guy that was kind of tossed to the curb. I mean, he was starting their opening preseason game. They didn't want anything to do with Josh Jacobs. And so it's good to see how this is unfolded. But the other element to this performance was Josh Jacobs was dealing with a calf injury. I mean, he was limited in practice on Friday and then aggravated the injury in the third quarter. So putting that in the context of this performance makes it even more impressive. But 49% of Josh Jacobs' rushing yards were over expectation, nearly 3 yards per rush over expectation. Only Latavius Murray had a better mark this week. And Jacobs was also a factor in the pass game, made that ridiculous one-handed grab in the second half down the sideline, led the team in receiving yards as well, more than 12 yards a catch, caught 6 of 7 targets. So that was a performance where Josh Jacobs just put the entire offense on his back, and it was just a wildly impressive performance, especially when you think about that calf injury.
Yeah, I'm not sure where the Seahawks defenders were in that second and third level on the 86-yard touchdown run, but maybe that's because they elected to put 12 players out there on the first interception of Derek Carr to get an incremental man out there blocking to try and return that kick. But a big win for the Raiders. Seattle looks like they're coming back to earth a little bit. We'll see how the Seahawks get Price going forward. Before we pivot away from the good into the bad, Payne, wanted to give you a final word in this category.
Well, I see you have Ezekiel Elliott on here. I know you've been slandering the man for the last month.
Yeah, but I am a fair, level-headed man that grades people based on what you've done for me lately. And Ezekiel Elliott reminded us that it's not just the Tony Pollard show. We saw him show a little bit of burst, acceleration, season-high 92 yards as he seems to own the New York Football Giants. Took on a bigger workload than Pollard as a running back. And when you look at Ezekiel Elliott, now has 6 touchdowns in his last 4 games overall that he's played. Continues to get the lion's share of the goal line touches. What blew me away with that particular market, Payne, Tony Pollard was about a minus $1.50 favorite for an anytime touchdown. Zeke at +120. I'm very curious to see how odds makers will elect to price that particular prop for Sunday Night Football when the Cowboys take on the Colts.
I think Ezekiel Elliott's carved out his role. And as long as we're just cognizant and we're all self-aware and we're all just viewing this properly, Ezekiel Elliott's overpaid. We know that. And Tony Pollard has the much higher ceiling and upside. But this is a nice 1-2 punch here. Pollard and Elliott have just drastically different running styles right now. And if you can get Ezekiel Elliott 12 carries a game where, you know, he's pounding the defense and wearing them down for Tony Pollard to come in potentially late and use his explosiveness, or you're using Ezekiel Elliott in short yardage situations and goal line situations where he's vulturing touchdowns like Williams, the kid from Detroit, like that feels like where we're at right now with Ezekiel Elliott. And if he continues to play that role well, there's no reason that him and Pollard can't share that backfield.
Yep. They're trying to figure things out offensively. And while Kellen Moore draws a ton of ire and scrutiny, this offense looks to be trending in the right direction. We'll see if the Cowboys are able to add another weapon. Should they be able to land Odell Beckham Jr., assuming he can stay coherent when he's on airplanes going back and forth across the country?
It is that time of year where Kellen's offense becomes a little bit stagnant. So we'll see how this transpires down the stretch run. Yes, that was interesting. Depends on who you talk to, but apparently he was taking a nap, they claim, and didn't want to wear the seatbelt. Who knows? Who knows? I don't think it hinders his ability to get picked up here. I want to say this before we transition. For the first time ever, I see your notes here, and there's something called entertainment value. I've never seen that before. What is that?
Yeah, so, I mean, looking at NFL PR, they put out press releases after most of the games are done before Sunday Night Football, and they usually have some unique tidbits that they'll include in that, and I guess this stood out to me. The 2022 season is the fourth season now that the regular season overtime rule was instituted in 1974 to feature an overtime game in at least 10 of the first 12 weeks, joining 2010 and 11 of the first 12 weeks. 2003, where 11 of the 12 had an overtime game, and 2021 and 10 of 12. There have also been 36 games in which a team has overcome a deficit of at least 10 points to win or tie a game this season. The Chargers accomplished that feat this past weekend. We talk all the time how difficult it is to win in the National Football League. It's a league that prides itself on parity, where every single year you have a team that goes from worst to first. And right now, the league has achieved that on a variety of levels. Yes, there are a couple of teams that are heads and shoulders above everybody else, but that middle class, so to speak, is a lot better or worse. I'm not right sure the best way to describe it than what we've seen in the past, mainly because you only have a couple of teams that are true bottom feeders and dregs.
It's been a wild season, and some of these end games have been ridiculous. And, you know, moving parts in the market before games start is a good thing. Right? Pro bettors should be able to get their hands on better information quicker than odds makers. But when boatloads of variance strike during the game, that's a different story. And, you know, that can be frustrating for any level of bettor. And, you know, it's just led to one of the wackiest NFL seasons I've been a part of. And really, no matter how buttoned up you are, even if you're cognizant that once you place your bet and get your money in good, there's not a damn thing you can do to change that outcome, but there's still these couple minutes of frustration immediately after the fact. And yesterday, I think the total comes to mind yesterday that we were a part of. And, you know, we kind of, I don't want to use this as a venting station, but it does give you the peek behind the curtain of, it's not just you, the listener, but what we go through as well. Todd and I were a part of the Ravens-Jaguars game. And, you know, my group originated that under 46 and 45 and a half early in the week. And the game closed 43. And, you know, it's just a monster edge when you think about going through the 44. And it's 12 to 10 with 13 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. It's a dead nut winner. And then you get 30 yards to score 10 points, and second and longs become pretty easy, and Trevor Lawrence plays the fourth quarter of his life, converting multiple fourth and longs, and all hell breaks loose, and two position swings unfold when easy winners turn to losers. And I think the cherry on top for us, Todd, was the Ravens' futures become a little bit dicier, because that's now their fourth blown 2-score lead in the fourth quarter through 11 games.
Yeah, that's a bet that should have won about 3 weeks ago, and you mentioned it. I mean, getting the best of the number on some of these things, even if the Ravens don't convert the two, granted, you don't know Jacksonville's going to march down the field and get the game-winning touchdown, that contest has a chance to fall 45, but just the sequencing of events that go on. And I was actually listening to a post-game radio show, and I wish I remember which one it was, Payne, and they're talking and recapping the scores, and it's got a gambling spin on it, and they go, the Jaguars-Ravens game goes flying over the total, and I don't typically get all that angry, but my blood pressure did start to get ratcheted up when you hear that. You look at the final score and realize what it took to get that game over, you know, the 43, the 44, the 45, and the 45 and a half to 46, where most of the position was. And it's no different than the Washington Commanders first half, where Taylor Heinicke has the ball in plus territory with 20 seconds to go. We need a field goal, and lo and behold, he throws a pick, and it crushed the hopes and dreams of us laying 2.5 in that first half. But
it
happens. It's nature of the beast, and unfortunately that level of variance that you alluded to that everyone deals with. And it's why we always preach good money management, because no matter how many things you do right, you still need some of those bounces and that coin to come up 51-49 heads for the dead nuts winners you have to layer on top of all that.
Did you watch the second quarter of Atlanta and Washington, or were you kind of, I know you were doing some things, you were on the road some of the holiday, were you watching that? Or
I watched parts of it. That one didn't get my undivided attention like some of the others that were there. I watched most of that first quarter, and when you convert a second and 25 or whatever it was from the 47 yard line, it may or may not have gotten shuffled off one of my screens to try and watch other games where I could come in with a much more clear head and objective mind.
Yeah, I think, you know, there was probably, just again peeling back the curtain when we give out these best bets, it's, you know, there's a couple that we were looking at, and when you're talking small sample size, when variance hits negatively, it can cause some things to look worse than they are. But that was a situation where you're spot on. I mean, second and 25 worth an offense that's pretty inept passing, and Atlanta picks it up and goes down and scores a touchdown in that drive. But it wasn't just the final seconds there. You had the prior drive where Taylor Heinicke overthrows a touchdown on first down, and then he overthrows a touchdown on third down, and so you're sitting at 10-10. And you do, you get the ball back in plus territory, first down, 24 seconds to go, all three timeouts. You're like, oh, this is going to be solid. We're going to get in field goal range here. And first down interception, no pressure on Taylor Heinicke. I don't know where he was throwing that, but
I don't think he does either.
Not the end result we wanted.
Yeah, I don't think he knows where he was throwing the football either. But all right, I guess this provides the perfect way for us to segue
more bad
from the good, from the good into the bad. And I'll kick it off here, and I'm going to throw cold water on the Bucs. I really thought for extended stretches yesterday against Cleveland, this was a team that had figured it out. They were going to start trending in the right direction, be able to get a hard-fought road victory. A David Njoku one-handed grab on 4th and 11 had other ideas, but the Bucs offense deserves that level of accountability, not the defense that melted down late. They were held scoreless on their final 7 possessions of the game. The Bucs average under 5 yards per play under 5 yards per pass. You know, you look at Chris Godwin, he, of course, was the security blanket that Tom Brady needed, had 12 catches for 110 yards. Mike Evans was more or less an afterthought on the outside. Credit to, you know, what the Browns were able to do to neutralize him with a talented rookie defender. But to add insult to injury, the Bucs could lose Tristan Wirfs, maybe not season-ending, but for an extended period of time along that much-maligned offensive grouping.
You're just bringing up all the good games this week, huh?
I mean, like we said, this is a safe space. It's cathartic, and we got to get it out one way or another.
So another game that early on in the week we laid 2.5 minus 20, watch it close 3.5, and can't hold on to a 7-point lead late. So that was basically, and it's crazy that even with all of the crap that unfolded yesterday, if tonight rolls the right way, it's a very minuscule winning week, but that's just how frustrating the season's been. I'm going to say this a little louder and maybe more pronounced since the Buccaneers continue to give you a hard on, Todd. Every week I feel like we're talking about this team.
I keep waiting in the NFC. The reason is
I know you keep waiting. What do you keep waiting for?
I've resigned to the fact that I'm not waiting for anything at this point. They're going to be the worst graded division champion in the NFC, and they're going to get bounced out in the opening round wildcard weekend.
Well, I mean, they may play like Geno Smith or I mean, they might not get bounced out, right? That's ultimately what could transpire here. This is very much about inept coaching, right? Nothing less, nothing more. The Buccaneers have a bottom five coaching staff, and sure, like the injuries suck, and you mentioned Christian Wirfs going down again, but just roll the tape on the preseason preview. Roll the tape anytime I've talked about Todd Bowles being a fantastic Indian, but one of the worst Chiefs ever. And you would think, right, like no matter how conservative of a coach you are, that one day you would wake up and be like, shit, I only won 37% of my games as a Jets head coach, was fired. Now another defensive-minded coach with quarterback problems has the Jets in the playoffs if they were to start today. Right? Shit. Like virtually the same Buccaneers team that won a Super Bowl with Arians is now below 500 under my watch. And if Bowles was self-aware and just had those thoughts, you know, you might have like this George Costanza-like moment where everything he does just does the opposite, right? And that might pan out a little bit better. But I watched every snap of that game, and forget the fact that Brady and Mike Evans aren't on the same page right now. The Buccaneers led 17-10 halfway through the third quarter. The offense was fine at that point when you think about weather conditions. It was wet. It was windy. Where the total closed. Who bet that total under, right? They were exceeding expectations, in my view, to that point when you think about all of those factors. But the next five drives after being up 17-10, there were seven first down situations. Byron Leftwich called a running play on five of the six and a pass the line of scrimmage on the seventh. It's as conservative as it gets. You're playing not to lose. There's 13 minutes left in the fourth quarter. Tampa's still up 17-10. There's a fourth and 1.5 from the Browns' 37-yard line. Okay? You have Tom fucking Brady. The defense you're playing against is 31st in schedule-adjusted efficiency. You can take a double-digit lead and end the game. Todd Bowles elects for a delay of game. Punts from the Browns 42, and it of course goes into the end zone. Bowles didn't think the risk of losing 17 yards in field position was worth putting it in Tom Brady's hands against the second worst defense in the league. Like, think about how conservative that is. And then, to me, the biggest snafu, and it's tough to think about that after what I just said, that this would be the biggest snafu. Todd Bowles' specialty, defense, great defensive mind. Cleveland's final drive in regulation. It's a 4th and 10 with 32 seconds left. You get a stop, the game's over. The Buccaneers have three timeouts left at that point. Any coach with a pulse lets the opposing offense break the huddle, gets a look at their formation, and then calls timeout to make sure you're in the right defense, right? Allow your pass rushers to get a last breather so they can go balls to the wall and create natural pressure. Nope. Bowles saw the formation the Browns were in on 4th and 10 and thought, you know what? I love the idea of David Njoku, who's 6'5", 250, runs like a gazelle, and has a large catch radius, going against the worst cover linebacker this league has seen the last 4 years in Devin White. Quite literally, that's the biggest matchup advantage the Browns had yesterday. If you ask Kevin Stefanski, hey, if you could handpick one of your offensive players and handpick one of the Buccaneers' defensive players to attack, which two players would you choose? 100 out of 100 times, Stefanski says, Njoku versus Devin White. And Todd Bowles, with three timeouts, saw this formation and didn't call timeout. Said, you know what, I like that. Let's go with that. Horrific coaching. This is literally a bottom five staff right now. And it's not even debatable.
I don't know where we go for an encore from a bad standpoint in this particular classification. So I'm dying to know what you have on your little notepad in front of you.
Well, you have Seattle, so we can transition there, but I feel like I need to, we can just end the podcast there. That Bucs game left me irate, and it's very few times, right? You get the initial, like, 90 seconds of just being fuming mad and cussing, then you just move on. That one lingered for about 7-8 minutes.
Yeah, you got to afford yourself 3 to 5 minutes max if you're going to do this week in, week out. When games take more than that, to your point, there are some that sit under your skin and are tougher to kind of expunge in the hour to 90 minutes post-mortem, and then it's even worse when you dig back into the numbers and try and figure out good bet, bad bet, or you became a victim of variance in any capacity. Yeah, I mean, I talked about Josh Jacobs' performance in the good and what he did there, but the Seahawks defense obviously has a cross to bear here. You give up 293 yards passing. You give up 283 yards rushing. The Raiders average 7.5 yards per play. We talked about the broken call or whatever it was with an 86-yard touchdown run in overtime, and the Raiders record 570 76 yards of offense on Sunday. They're the fourth team in the Super Bowl era with at least 275 yards passing and 275 yards rushing, joining the 2012 San Francisco 49ers, the 1986 Cincinnati Bengals, and the 1978 Cowboys. And on the flip side, Seattle's ground game completely non-existent. 23 carries as a team for 65 yards. We kept waiting for the other shoe to drop, and this has been a successful season for Seattle, even if they don't win another football game the rest of the way, given what they've had out of their rookie class. But coming out of the bye, that team had no answers defensively, and I'm not quite sure who best to point fingers at for that.
I think we thought their defense was a little bit fraudulent. Certainly they were making some improvements, but you looked at the schedule of offense it had played leading up to the Buccaneers game, and I think that was one of our main handicaps for that Germany game, was like, hey, yes, they've improved a little bit defensively, but they haven't played a soul. I think the other thing here is expectation creates pressure. And when you reach your win total 8 weeks into the season and suddenly find yourself atop the division, playing fast and free isn't a thing anymore, right? That the conversation changes a little bit. Geno Smith's doing interviews all week long, and the conversation's now you can win the division, right? Can you hold on to that multi-game lead? Can you make the playoffs and go on a little bit of a run here? And it's just a different vibe now, right? I mean, Seattle was handled easily by Tampa in Germany. That final score wasn't remotely close to what transpired on the field. And then off the bye, you drop a home game to the Raiders team that's kind of searching for some confidence, and now you're looking up at San Francisco. I am really intrigued. I understand they have a game that they're favored in against the Rams this week, but it's a different vibe right now. There's pressure, and so far Seattle hasn't handled that pressure well the last two games.
We talk about it all the time, and when you teams, no matter what level, whether it's college football, the NFL, or any other sports, it's such a different mentality when you go from the hunter to suddenly being the hunted, and you have a target on your back each and every week. If you're not able to get yourself up and be buttoned up where you need to be, it's very difficult to overcome odds makers' expectations. We saw that on full display with the Raiders pulling off the outright upset. All right, into the ugly then, and I want to start this off, Payne, with an individual that I'm not quite sure what he was doing with the game hanging in the balance, the Tennessee Titans. They hold the Cincinnati Bengals, have a chance to get off the field down 7 with about a minute and a half to go. Kevin Strong along that Titans defensive line had other ideas, an unnecessary roughness call deciding to run through the long snapper, which accomplished absolutely nothing. It allowed the Bengals to accept the penalty, and because clock was working in their favor, take knees, securing a 20-16 victory. There's things that happen in sports, regardless of level, especially at the professional ranks. If it's about an effort and energy play, you can understand why mistakes happen. But when you have brain cramps at key junctures, if I was a head coach in Mike Vrabel's spot, I would have absolutely lost my shit on the sidelines, knowing that you took away an opportunity for our offense to at least have a chance to even the score, maybe even win with a late two-point conversion.
That was one of the wildest games of the week in terms of market leading up to kickoff. You know, we had saw some early week movement on Cincinnati that was very sharp, drove it up to as high as 3 around Friday afternoon, 1 o'clock, as Team USA was kicking off. And then a group came in and took out the threes from the market. And Tennessee, some places, ended up closing -1. Part of that initial movement on the Bengals was the idea that Joe Mixon and Jamar Chase might play. And fortunately, we get really good injury information from Deepak, and he was kind of steadfast in the mindset that those two would not play. But ultimately, this game comes down to what most of the Titans games come down to, and that they're a different team in the second half when the script wears off offensively. And we know Lou Anarumo makes some great halftime adjustments defensively. And so we can look at this moment for Kevin Strong. And candidly, I was an owner of a Titans teaser, so I was wildly happy that Ryan Tannehill wasn't going to be back out on offense chucking the ball in known passing situations. I loved the penalty and loved seeing the knees and knew we were in the clear there. But this, it wasn't just one play. It came down to the second half. And in that second half, the Bengals started to surge a little bit. They were finding their way on offense. Samaje Perine was fantastic. The Bengals in the second half, you know, 52% success rate. The Titans, 41%. success rate. So a net positive 11% in that second half. And that's ultimately what won it. The Bengals were able to move the ball a little bit in that second half.
I had one other thing on my ugly list, but it's low-hanging fruit, so I'm not even sure it bears me wasting time on it. But the Denver Broncos. I mean, Payne, when does it end for this football team? Now, thankfully, it worked out.
Soon.
Thankfully, it worked out in our favor the way we needed it to. But, I mean, Broncos' offensive ineptitude continues to reach new lows, so much so that you have viral footage of Mike Purcell more or less telling Russell Wilson to shut his fucking mouth on the sidelines. The Denver Broncos, 246 yards of offense, 4.3 yards per play, and normally you give teams a longer leash when you have a veteran quarterback and a first-year head coach, but this team looks absolutely lost, and there doesn't appear to be any light at the end of the tunnel.
Is that what they were arguing about? I thought Purcell might have liked his Subway sub a little bit spicier, and there was some misrepresentation of
that. He might have wanted to live dangerously and let the Denver Broncos defense play all 110 snaps in an NFL football game instead of letting the Broncos offense out there.
So if you remove fourth downs and only look at the first three quarters when the game was not in garbage time, Denver had a negative 0.35 EPA per play, second worst mark of the week. The only offense worse than Denver yesterday had a quarterback starting that was making $2.5 million this year. That was Kyle Allen and the Texans. Okay. You mentioned players fighting with each other. We're past the point of like letting Russ cook, and we're now asking if he's actually cooked. And you mentioned this potentially coming to a head, but Nathaniel Hackett is so far in over his head at this point. And again, it's like the George Costanza reference where he's trying to figure out the Penske file. Like, Hackett's done, right? He'll never be a head coach in this league again. He's going to be fired. The only question is when. Is it next week? Is it week 16? Is it the day after the Broncos' miserable season ends? He's gone, because this is ugly, and they just don't look competent. I understand there's some injuries along the offensive line, but this offense was better with worse quarterbacks and a defensive-minded head coach. And Nathaniel Hackett's supposed to be an offensive mind. He's gone. And he'll never be a head coach in this league ever again.
Yeah, it hasn't been.
And we've surmised that over, what, an 8, 9, 10, 11-game sample size? I think we kind of knew 4 or 5 weeks in. And it's tough because you kind of want guys to go through the growing pains. But this is bad. This is really bad.
Yeah, not exactly a good look for anybody wearing Denver Broncos colors that has something to do with the offensive identity of this football team. And it probably undersells a defense that has been absolutely lights out, that's getting no support on the other side of the football. All right, anything for the ugly before we get into a couple look-ahead lines and we give the floor to our good doc, Deepak?
Let's get to the look-ahead lines.
All right, look-ahead numbers here. And like we do, because we're consummate pros around here, we go right into Ravens Broncos, where the Ravens were a 6.5-point home favorite for next Sunday's date against Denver. Right now, as you look at your odds screen in front of you, we see that the Baltimore Ravens are out to an 8-point favorite. I don't think this one needs a whole hell of a lot of explanation, but you have gone through a key number of 7.
9. We're now as high as 9 at the sharpest shops. So I think it was pretty self-explanatory. I know the Ravens lost yesterday, but if you are maneuvering your power numbers and shaping them, I think ultimately you're not downgrading Baltimore, as crazy as that's going to sound, because they went on the road and built a 9-point lead despite that game closing 3.2 with all of the injury stuff surrounding Lamar Jackson, right? Was dealing with a little bit of a hip injury. Was dealing with an illness for about the 47th time in the last 38 weeks.
Yeah, send him some Zycam, would you, Christ almighty? Help that dude's immune system at this point.
So you just kind of look at that fourth quarter melt. And yes, you might have to make an adjustment for that because it's now been 4 times in 11 weeks. But ultimately, no one's really downgrading the Ravens off that performance. And we're downgrading the Broncos in a major way. I do think at some point, though, right, total at 38. I mean, there's probably going to be some value at Denver. It's just a matter of which faction of better are you going to be. And this was something we discussed, right, on Thanksgiving Day, and both sides came up spades. Are you going to quickly get out ahead and play your advantage teaser on the Ravens? Or are you going to come back when this gets to 10 and value bet the dog? We saw both of those scenarios play out quite well for the Dallas and Bills games to start the day on Thanksgiving.
Houston Texans, they'll welcome in Deshaun Watson for his much anticipated debut as a member of the Cleveland Browns. You did have Cleveland a 5-point favorite in the look ahead market, number out to 7. Again, I don't want to give the market too much credit because given what we've seen this year, but I have to imagine the 5 number included Deshaun in the mix, and this is more because the Houston Texans have looked downright inept for multiple weeks at an end.
So Kyle Allen's a downgrade over Davis Mills. And I really can't figure out that situation where you have this coaching staff and you're like, hey, we're going to start Kyle Allen. I think we know what Kyle Allen is at this point. And I understand Davis Mills has been wildly disappointing and the play hasn't been very good, but you need to figure out what you have. Keep him out there. And if you find out that he's not your guy, which I think you've probably done, there's no reason to go to Kyle Allen. So that's a downgrade there. And then you have the potential upgrade of Watson. I don't think we really need to get into, like, is he going to hit the ground running after not playing football for the last, 18 months? So there's probably going to be a transition period there, but you get the Browns with the upset win. And those are all the factors that have caused this to move.
Seahawks, we talked about them a little bit earlier. They were a 3-point road favorite within the division as they'll head down the coast to take on the Los Angeles Rams, despite coming into a game fresh off a loss. They have now moved into that 4.5-5-point range, which Payne obviously has more to do with the current state of the Los Angeles Rams than it is anything with the Seattle Seahawks.
Yeah, let's see who's under center for the Rams. I think this game,
Kurt Warner,
probably has some intrigue to it, and we'll see ultimately who's under center there.
Could we get Kurt Warner back? I mean, does he have anything left in the tank at this point? I mean, it's quick from the NFL Network studios at SoFi. Get him out there under center to lead Sean McVay's offense. But yeah, 3 to 4.5 on that particular game.
Out to five and a half.
Yep, I'm looking right now. Good call. Out to 5.5. Chargers, Raiders, divisional game here as well. The Chargers were a 3-point favorite on the road for their trip to Allegiant Stadium. That number has come off the key. There is 1-2 out there, but 2.5, basically the consensus.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Raiders showed pretty well here, and I understand the Chargers had a nice victory, but once again, down double digits, battling your way back, and Justin Herbert pulls out the rabbit out of the hat again and just leads his team to victory. So ultimately, that's what you're seeing here, is the market not really respecting the Chargers' win last week because, again, the win on the scoreboard, but you just think about the play throughout a game, and you're down double digits to the Arizona Cardinals, who are an absolute disaster. And obviously, the Raiders are showing some fight here, back-to-back wins. Get it done in overtime. And then, you know, it just feels like maybe a little bit of a different vibe there. So ultimately, we'll see where this line goes, but we're down to 2 at some of the sharp shops.
When you look at the way the Chargers have performed, to your point, Brandon Staley stays on that front foot, goes for 2 there, puts the game over the total, allows the Chargers to win as 1. Arizona Cardinals backers, who had tickets on the right side all day, collective sigh of relief as they don't have to sweat out overtime down there in Glendale. You can follow Payne on Twitter, at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You, of course, can follow me there as well. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. But better than the three of us, if you're looking for injury updates on a week-in, week-out basis, you're going to want to follow our next guest. That's Deepak Shona, and his Twitter handle is at SportMDAnalysis. Deepak provides all the injury updates on a lot of the NFL's marquee players.
Are you injured or are you hurt?
When injuries occur in the NFL, you need someone to call on.
If you're hurt, you can still play. If you're injured, you can't.
Let's check in with Dr. Deepak Chona. Stanford and Harvard-trained orthopedic sports surgeon and founder of SportsMed Analytics, the industry leader in data-driven injury analysis.
So are you hurt or are you injured?
All right. Well, thank you, Todd. Lots to talk about today on the injury report, so we will dive right in, starting with Aaron Rodgers. Now, he took a couple of shots to the ribcage area, reportedly no fractures seen on x-ray. You can't always tell immediately from the x-rays alone, so he's probably going to undergo some more tests this week. Now, the key is, even if there's no fracture, he's not really in the clear just yet, because these are very painful injuries, and we saw Justin Herbert be affected by one of these early in the year. He was able to come back without missing any time, And Aaron Rodgers is likely dealing with a similar situation where he could force his way back and use some protective padding over the area in addition to some numbing injections. But otherwise, every time he throws a deep ball or a bullet pass, this injury is going to hurt. So with the Packers losing, Aaron Rodgers older, you wouldn't necessarily be surprised to see them say, let's sit you, play Jordan Love, and get you healthy before you come back. Then you have Tristan Wirfs. Now, the video of the injury looked pretty severe. He got his leg rolled up on, but the x-rays were negative, so most likely what we're dealing with is a high ankle sprain. He'll get an MRI and we'll know a little bit more. Most moderate severity high ankle sprains for offensive line, you're looking at 2 to 3 weeks on average. Now, again, we'll know a little more, but early reports from Tampa are optimistic, so we may be looking at lower severity on this side. Then we have Teron Armstead, and he has a pec strain that knocked him out of the game. Luckily, though, they're not calling it a pec tear. A tear is what we saw TJ Watt deal with earlier in the year, where it made him miss about 2 months and sometimes need surgery. So with a pec strain, usually you would expect return in about 2 weeks, but we'll know a little bit more, another MRI situation that'll tell the story. Then we have Travis Etienne. Now, the most common issue for Etienne here would be a midfoot sprain, but bearing weight on the sideline bodes well. He wasn't in any boot or crutches after the game, so to be determined on his status, but we would lean towards him playing week 13. Then Christian McCaffrey. Now, the reporting of inflammation and irritation in the knee, plus the combination of his brace, suggests a diagnosis of patellar tendonitis. If so, this is a type of injury that benefits from rest and load management. So it wouldn't be totally surprising if CMC is out for some practices, but then able to play in games. We'd also expect some more committee work when games are in hand, and if the Niners clinch early, you may see him rest towards the end of the year in order to get fully healthy for the playoffs. Then Michael Carter. Now, the team is calling it an ankle injury, but they're not specifying high or low. And that's an important distinction because most low ankle sprains will be played through without missed time by running backs. High ankles are more commonly going to cause 2 or more weeks out. Average for moderate severity high ankle is 2 to 4 weeks. The return to practice timeline will help clarify things a lot. If he's back on the practice field by Thursday, probably just dealing with a low ankle sprain that is not going to cause any lingering impact. If he's not there by Thursday, I'm leaning towards high ankle as a diagnosis. And then we have Joe Mixon, very likely to clear concussion protocol for week 13. Running backs coming off of concussions don't generally see any negative performance hit, so we're overall optimistic about Mixon and reinserting him back into lineups next week. Then we have Raheem Mostert. Now, he's also likely coming back week 13, but Mostert has a history of multiple knee issues, so we would expect some load management going forward, especially now that they seem to have a pretty good system in place for Jeff Wilson. Then Darnell Mooney. Now, unfortunately, less optimism here. The video looked like he had a moderate or severe high ankle, and then they're already saying he may be considering surgery, which suggests to me that the x-rays showed something like displacement of the bones, which you can see in this case. This would likely be a tightrope type surgery. It's something that players come back from well, but it wouldn't be until the start of next year. Then Allen Robinson, another case of being shut down for the year. He's having surgery for a stress fracture in his foot, and there's a high success rate of healing this issue with surgery, but it won't be until the start of the 23 season. This isn't the type that should confer any additional durability risk, however, so Allen Robinson, if you believe that he may have a performance impact next year, then he could end up being a sleeper for you based on the combination of his performance this year plus the injury. Then we have Justin Fields. Now, I know he's been hot, we want to see him back, but we wouldn't be surprised if he rests week 13. You can play through this injury as a quarterback on your non-throwing shoulder, but there's a risk of worsening it, and I think most people wouldn't want their franchise quarterback risking anything on a shoulder for a losing season. And then Mike Williams. Now, re-aggravated high ankle sprains average 3 additional weeks out after players return, but they also cause lingering performance dips, lasting up to 2 weeks once they do come back. So Williams has an outside chance to return week 13. The more likely outcome, however, is week 14 or 15. But even when he first comes back, I'm holding off on putting him back into my lineup before I see him perform well for at least the first game. And then a little bit more optimistic view on Marquise Hollywood Brown. Now, he was back, he played fairly well, but not the full Brown output that you're looking for. But I do expect the training wheels and the snap count limits to come off next game. Usually you see a 2 week ramp up for wide receivers, and he will likely be a DFS sleeper value going into week 13. And then another buy low candidate and potential week 13 DFS sleeper, David Njoku. And we're very positive on him because he's had a high ankle sprain that's been at least moderate, maybe even higher severity than that. And it's really affected his stats. He's missed, of course, a lot of games. And then this was his first game back, and he performed reasonably well. He did have that touchdown, which helped his stats, but otherwise only about 20 yards. But now he's reaching the end of that window where the high ankle causes a typical performance dip. And add into that the fact that Deshaun Watson is returning. So things are pointing in the right direction for David Njoku. And then another optimistic outlook to finish off, Ja'Marr Chase. Now, he has a really strong chance to play week 13, and if he's active, we're starting him. Not necessarily expecting world-beating numbers immediately, but by week 14, he's very likely back to wide receiver one. And that's all for today, so thank you, Todd. I'll send it back to you.
An absolute mash unit, Payne. A list of the who's who that's out there. Didn't think when we went back and forth with Deepak yesterday about some of the players we wanted to cover that Aaron Rodgers was going to make that list, and knowing that Green Bay has an upcoming bye. He does own the Chicago Bears, so maybe that factors into his calculation a little bit. But Deepak didn't necessarily sound that optimistic that the Packers would rush him back, knowing that they'll have an extra week of recovery and maybe get a chance to look at Jordan Love against one of their heated division rivals.
Yeah, Jordan Love looked pretty competent late in that game, so maybe you toss him out there, and that's the start of this transition, potentially? I don't know. I mean, obviously, Aaron Rodgers is going to be fine. I don't know if he's going to play this week, as Deepak noted, and he certainly couldn't throw the ball more than 7 yards late in that game without just kind of clenching his ribs every single time, but I didn't think there was any structural damage, so we'll see what comes of this, but probably not a terrible idea now that your season's done to throw Love out there. And hey, sink or swim. I understand the contract's hefty, but what happens if Love goes out there and performs? I mean, there's certainly some quarterback needy teams that might want to take Aaron Rodgers off your hands, and so it might be the best approach this coming
might
week.
Might be awfully fascinating to see what happens there if Green Bay found a trade market for Jordan Love, or if they shipped Aaron Rodgers in the twilight of his career to a team that thought they were one piece away from making a push for the Lombardi Trophy. Obviously, as we always do, you're going to want to monitor these injury reports throughout the course of the week to figure out if these players get upgraded or downgraded for their team's game this coming weekend. On to Monday Night Football, Payne, where we have the Indianapolis Colts and the Pittsburgh Steelers. Indianapolis right now, a 2.5 point favorite pretty much everywhere. There is a 2 out there. There is a 3, depending on which side may be catching your eye. Total in this game, 39.5. The Colts, they've covered both games since Jeff Saturday took over as head coach. Meanwhile, the Pittsburgh Steelers, 3-7 start is the worst for the franchise going all the way back to 2003. When you look at the Indianapolis Colts, they've been an under juggernaut, with the under going 9-2 through their first 11 games, second best in the NFL behind Denver in that department. The Colts games are averaging a shade more than 35 total points per contest. Again, the second fewest behind the Denver Broncos. When you look at the way this game has played out in the betting market, clearly we've seen threes gobbled up when that was available, so I feel like the number is the most logical place to start here on the handicap.
Yeah, I think it's, you can kind of maybe weave this into the breakdown. I don't think this needs a really, really long one, but I mean, the Colts defense is banged up, you know, and that's part of this. We know their leader Shaq Leonard is out for the year. Their best pass rusher Kwity Paye is out. DeForest Buckner's going to play, but he missed most of the week with an illness. You have Zaire Franklin, the starting linebacker, come down with an illness on Friday. He's questionable. And Yannick Ngakoue is dealing with a back injury. He was a DNP Saturday at practice and is questionable. So let's monitor that situation from now until kickoff. But past that, right, like why pro bettors wiped out the 3 from the market on Pittsburgh is this massive dichotomy in schedule strength. And it's on both sides of the ball. I mean, Pittsburgh's faced the toughest schedule in the NFL to date, and they've done some decent things out of the bye week metrically that would kind of lead you in this direction.
Yeah, I mean, credit to you guys. I mean, I know we highlighted on our AFC North preview before the year, we said regardless of what the Steelers were able to accomplish on the field, we knew it could be a transition year given that they had one of the league's toughest strength of schedules. That has continued to be the case throughout the course of the year, and obviously contributing to the fact that this team is now 3-7, but priced accordingly and taking money from professional bettors for the second straight week. When you look at this Steelers offense, obviously Kenny Pickett has a much better rapport and chemistry with George Pickens. Diontae Johnson still trying to find his way in the offense. Jaylen Warren out for this game, so they do lose a change of pace back. If you're trying to identify a path of success for the Pittsburgh Steelers against the Colts, is it relying on Kenny Pickett to throw against this defense, or is it hoping that they can stay consistent and maybe build on back-to-back good rushing performance from Najee Harris, who looked like he was carrying a piano on his back through the first eight games of the season?
A little of both, right? I mean, I think ultimately what you're buying here is the idea that the Steelers are coming down in class a little bit because, again, they've faced the most difficult schedule of defenses. The Colts are, I would say, slightly above average defensively, but they're pretty banged up. And I just feel like the Steelers' bye week did them some good. And those midseason buys for young teams can be like a mini training camp where coaches can kind of enhance what's working, ditch what's not. And if you look since week 9, the Steelers are 10th in EPA per play. Kenny Pickett's been a touch more aggressive as well. Just looking at his rate of throws, 10 plus yards, it's increased 11% post bye. And the run game has been trending a little bit more efficiently, as you mentioned, with Najee Harris looking much healthier. They're top 5 in EPA per rush since week 7. And then you have George Pickens, whose usage probably isn't as high as it should be. He deserves more targets, but he's been that field stretcher and space creator for the Steelers offense. And if you just look in terms of value over an average receiver adjusted for schedule, Pickens is fringe top 20 in this league. And you've also seen Pat Freiermuth kind of start to ascend and be that security blanket for Kenny Pickett. And you just kind of look at that matchup specific to your question. Colts are below average in both receptions and yards allowed to the tight end position. The Colts, if you look at their defense, they live in zone. So Freiermuth should be able to find some holes there. Colts allowed more than an 8% touchdown rate to tight ends. That's, you know, not very good. That's a bottom 10 rate in the league. They also allow a shade less than 8.5 yards per target to the tight end position. Also a bottom 10 mark in the league. But I think the one thing, if you're watching this game at home, if Pittsburgh's going to pull off the upset, Kenny Pickett has to be better in the red zone. It seems like when space shrinks a little bit, so doesn't his play. He's completed less than 47% of pass attempts once that space gets condensed. And if you look since week 8, out of 41 quarterbacks with at least 2 red zone pass attempts, Kenny Pickett is 40th in passing EPA. So he's got to get that figured out a little bit better and turn some of those drives into touchdowns. We know, right? Like, there's not going to be a ton of red zone trips in a game with a total of 39.5. So when you get down there, you have to take advantage of that. Only Josh Allen is worse over that time frame, by the way, in the red zone, which is pretty shocking to me.
Hey, I mean, credit the Steelers, Payne. They got their first offensive touchdown of 10-plus yards this season last week in their 37-30 loss to the Bengals. The Steelers had gone 9 straight games to open the season without a touchdown coming from 10-plus yard. It was actually the longest such streak by any team since the 1932 Staten Island Stapleton. So I know that was a household name. We all know that roster. It's just like the murderer's row the Yankees put forth back then when you're talking about the NFL and the Staten Island Stapletons. On the other side of the ball, when you look at this Pittsburgh Steelers defense, clearly they've had problems against the pass. They've been surprisingly good against the run, allowing less than 4 yards per carry, which has them top 5 in that department. From an overall counting stat standpoint, top 10 in the league, giving up a shade more than 100 yards per game. And this Colts offense lacks a lot of big play potential. 17 or fewer points in all 6 of their losses. They're averaging 15.7 points per game overall. The offensive line consistently graded out one of the worst pass blocking units in the NFL, but for them, at least they're seeing glimpses of what Jonathan Taylor can do, despite him not going for 4 yards per carry last week in their 17-16 loss against the Eagles.
You know, the perception of Indianapolis from mainstream media over the last 3 weeks is kind of hilarious to watch. It's like a yo-yo.
They got a media guy as their head coach, Payne. You have to paint them in a positive light.
But it's no, it started with outrage and jokes that Jeff Saturday, Jim Irsay's drinking buddy, was hired with no real qualifications to suddenly like what a great hire it was because the Colts hung 25 points on the worst defense in the league and the Raiders and played the Eagles tough in one of the best spots of the entire season. So it's just, it's crazy how that's changed over the last 3 weeks. Fundamentally, you know, the Colts figured out what they want to be and can conceivably be on offense based upon their personnel, and that's just this quick short pass offense and a team that wants to run the ball. Matt Ryan's accurate but doesn't have a ton of arm strength left, and the Colts O-line can't really pass protect well for more than 2.5 seconds, and Jonathan Taylor's their best weapon, and Indy lacks a true number one receiver. So this is kind of how this offense is built right now. The Steelers, to the point at the top that we talked about, have played the number one schedule of offenses in the NFL. So they're stepping down in class here in a major way. And even if you remove the two Sam Ellinger starts, which you should yank from the data, the Colts are still dead last in schedule-adjusted offensive efficiency. The Steelers are seventh against the run. Since week 9, Pittsburgh's third in EPA per rush allowed. Only 25% of runs have graded successful. The Colts haven't gotten a ton of push from their offensive line, so you just wonder what type of game Jonathan Taylor's going to have. I know a couple sharp prop bettors are looking at his under rushing yards this evening. We'll see if that unfolds for them. I haven't quite gotten there yet, but I know that's going to be pretty sharp. And I think really where pro bettors found their edge in this matchup is the market not properly valuing the Steelers defense, right? TJ Watt's back, arguably the best defensive player in the league, worth 1.5 points. And when you only factor the Steelers defensive snaps with TJ Watt on the field, it's a unit that flirts with being top five. Without TJ Watt, it's below average. So you have to make that manual adjustment. When I look at my power numbers here, these two teams are dead equal right now, although you could make the case that even with the Colts win against the Raiders and cover against the Eagles, that they're kind of trending in opposite directions metrically. Like, the Colts are still not very good offensively, and you're kind of seeing some underlying metrics for Pittsburgh that are kind of blinking by signal. But again, these are two dead equal teams. You factor in home field advantage. It's Monday night, loud crowd in a dome. It's a rookie on the road for Monday Night Football. Like, 2.5 is the right number here. You can see why 3 was wiped out. The guys that didn't grab 3 immediately gravitated towards teasing the Steelers, getting through the 3 and the 7 in a low variance game with a total of 39, 39.5. And so that's everything I know on this game in terms of what's been bet, and that's kind of how I've approached it personally.
It's a lot of information in a short period of time to break down a game for two teams that will be home for the holidays, or I shouldn't say that. I guess they'll be home after week 18, barring some second half surge from the Indianapolis Colts if they're going to thrust themselves into the playoff race in the AFC. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me on Twitter as well. Most importantly, as always, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. And if you haven't already done so, subscribe to the Bet the Board newsletter, a friendly reminder in your inbox every single Friday about all the great things we're doing around these fine parts, including articles, additional podcasts, and everything you need to become a better investor in the sports space. Anything else, Payne, you would like to share with our loyal listeners before we say goodbye and reconvene on Wednesday to talk a little college football championship weekend?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground. Big Wednesday podcast ahead with conference championships, and Brad will come back into the fold, and boy, he's been propping us up. Guy can't lose right now. So that's been a fortunate addition, and we'll reconvene on Wednesday.
No, you can't wait to break down the great barn burner that we're going to see in Charlotte between North Carolina and Clemson. Clearly, you've had that game circled on your calendar all season long. For Payne and Amit,
is the best team in the ACC even playing?
No, they're not. And I'm not going to say nice things about Florida State offense, so that's about the only sentence you're getting. No, the best team in the ACC is not playing in the conference championship on Saturday. But this is the world we live in, Payne. When you can't close out games, you're not healthy in the middle of the year. Unfortunately, you don't get to reap the spoils the first Saturday in December. Want to thank all of you, our loyal listeners, as always, for sharing, retweeting, and letting people know and interacting with them about all the great things we're doing around these parts. So wherever your investments take you for Monday Night Football between the Steelers and Colts, hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.